Kenosha, 52 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News Time, 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I can't think of a book I have enjoyed reading as much as an incredible new memoir called Public Private, My Life with Joe Papp at the Public Theater. If anybody knows anything about theater, and specifically American theater and recent American theater, then surely you know the name of Joe Papp, who was founder of New York City's Public Theater, which was responsible for some of the most important theatrical projects over the course of several decades. And Joe Papp was someone who played an integral role in all kinds of important undertakings, including the free Shakespeare performances in Central Park and a host of amazing works, including Hair, A Chorus Line, and others. And at his side for many years of his extraordinary theatrical career was Gail Merrifield Papp, who eventually became his wife. And she has sat down to write an incredible memoir about their life together in the theater. The book is titled Public Private, My Life with Joe Papp at the Public Theater. It is published by Applause Theater and Cinema Books. And it is clearly a labor of love. And it is a book I have thoroughly enjoyed exploring. And I'm excited for this opportunity to speak with her about it. Gail Merrifield Papp, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Delighted to be here.
Your husband, Joseph Papp, passed away back in the fall of 1991. I'm curious to know about the timing of the writing of this memoir. Had you thought seriously about the possibility of doing something like this even quite some time ago? Or is there any particular reason that now was the time that you sat down to tell this story in this way?
Yes, I think there is a reason why I wrote it now, because I felt that since this theater was founded on the democratic idea that's attracted three generations of outstanding actors, playwrights, and audiences, that there was something in the DNA of the theater itself that was inherited from Joe, which was his fiercely democratic belief that there should be free access for Shakespeare in the city's parks and playgrounds, which went hand in hand, really, with his way of casting those original free Shakespeare productions, regardless of color or ethnicity, in all roles, including the major ones, which had not been the case before. So people had a chance to see a black Hamlet or a Puerto Rican Hamlet, rather than having those wonderful actors excluded from consideration for those roles. So the original audiences that came and still come identify very strongly with the people that they see on stage. So they have a personal investment that rings true to them and is a very powerful kind of connection that continues. It's marvelous to see that in our audiences. his idea of free access was something when I first came to work in the park. That rang bells of access and freedom to me, because when I was growing up during the late Depression and World War II, my parents never had enough money to buy books at a bookstore. It just didn't happen. So the only way I could ever read a book as a child or in my teens was to go to the public library and borrow it. That was my only access. So Joe's idea, comparing his idea of theater to free access to books at the public library, really rang bells for me, and I became immediately attached to his ideas and to his theater, and eventually to him also.
Of course. And clearly you feel that spirit which animated so much of what he did is a spirit that we need in 2023 now more than ever.
Exactly. That's exactly it. I felt that there is a need for someone to try to communicate what has happened in the past, to make the past live again in a meaningful way for the present, the sorely distressed present. And I thought that Joe's example was useful in that respect, to show younger people how he dealt with certain problems in the past. Some of the problems we have today resemble those that he confronted in the past, and I was there to see how he dealt with them in various ways. And I thought that was instructive for younger people today, especially, who can probably learn from inspiring examples in the past of how they might adapt their own way of dealing with the present. I felt that was useful, and I wanted to try to communicate that in a library way.
I think you've done a wonderful job of that, and I want to just add parenthetically that one of the other things that is such a delight in this book is that so much of it occurs decades ago, before there was an internet, before there were ATMs, before there were cell phones. I mean, right. All kinds of modern conveniences we completely take for granted, and a lot of what Joe Papp and you and others accomplished, it sets it in proper context. How difficult a book was this to write? I'm just curious, when we're talking about a life lived over decades, a rich, complex life full of amazing events of one kind or another, how much of a challenge was it to kind of make sense of it all, to remember it all, and to write about it as beautifully as you do?
Well, it was a challenge. The main challenge was in the writing, because I worked with writers at the public theater, with playwrights. So, and I come from a family of writers, so I have a very strong idea of what good writing for any purpose whatsoever looks like and feels like. So I had that same standard for myself, and when it comes to trying to fulfill an idea of that sort, you've been able to communicate to other people, you apply it to yourself, it's entirely different. So I struggled with the writing. I had a lot of help in the editorial aspect of it, with very useful pointers and criticisms along the way. Emotionally, it was not difficult, because I'd been through the emotional phase of missing Joe. And although I will miss him forever, of course, I'm not in the active stage of grief that I was when the period after he passed. So trying to remember our life together has been a affirmative and enriching kind of experience, and not an emotionally difficult one that I had to struggle with.
So maybe in some ways this was the, in terms of emotionally, this was the time to write this book, when you were...
I think so. Yeah. Yes, I absolutely think so, for the reasons you've just pointed out so well.
Yes. What's interesting, however, is we're, you know, for a moment touching on his death back in 1991, and how much you continue to miss him, of course. It's very interesting to me that your book begins, that is, chapter one, begins in 1991, with your husband's death, and more right. specifically, with the memorial service that was held the very next day at the Public Theater, of course, the right. Theater that he had helped to create so many years earlier. Explain to our listeners what very recently came to light, which allowed you for the first time since that day to, in a sense, relive that day. But I'm also curious why you wanted to begin your book with this extraordinary scene of your husband's memorial service.
Well, yes, thank you for asking that question. It was, almost 25 or more years after that memorial service, which I only dimly recollected, that I learned by accident that it had been filmed. I just had no idea that, and that the film was at the Lincoln Center Library. So I went up there to watch it all those years later. And although I knew roughly who had been present and who spoke, watching it after all those years was just amazing, because the roster of people who spoke represented some of the actors and other artists who'd started their early careers with Joe. They included Meryl Streep, Kevin Kline, Raul Julia, the director James Lapine, and many, many others, Martin Sheen. All of these people had started their careers early with Joe, most of them in the park, some at the Public Theater, and they all had remarkable connection with him and spoke very feelingly about their personal reminiscences of their association with him. Meryl said that Joe was the only boss that she'd ever loved. So it was just an amazing thing to watch all those years later on the video at Lincoln Center Library. And I thought, well, the younger generation doesn't necessarily know all of this history. They'll know people like James Earl Jones as the voice of Darth Vader, but they don't realize he did nearly 10 Shakespeare productions out in the open air and on the touring mobile theater that Joe had. So I thought there's some value for a reader to know up front about all of this. So that's why I put it at the beginning of the book.
I'm glad it's there. And by the way, I'm also glad that you mentioned the fact that traditional Jewish practice is that such a memorial service, whatever its scope, needs to happen the very next day. So this extraordinary event is planned in a breathtakingly short amount of time. And just the fact that this glittering array of theatrical luminaries would come together on such short notice. I mean, that speaks volumes. Yeah, it speaks volumes of for the esteem with which your husband Joseph Papp was very justly held.
Yes. No, I was just amazed, and I was kind of a daze myself the very next day, as you can imagine. So I was just astonished to see this array of wonderful people in this theater. Including a rabbi, including the former mayor, David Dinkins, and others who, on a moment's notice, gathered together the very next day to speak at this memorial, which was held at the Public Theater. And it was an extraordinary event, just extraordinary.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Gail Merrifield Papp about her new book, Public Private: My Life with Joe Papp at the Public Theater. It is a memoir based on her years of working with and eventually being married to theatrical genius Joe Papp, the founder of New York City's The Public Theater, and someone whose theatrical career included all kinds of extraordinary and groundbreaking successes. When we move more to what we would think of as sort of the beginning of your book, Chapter 2. The year is 1965. You are 29 years old, and you are at something of both a personal and professional crossroads. Explain what made this year challenging and so crucial in terms of setting up ultimately the life you would begin to lead with Joe Papp?
Well, in 1965, I was a crossroads, because I had recently been divorced and unexpectedly, and I had also just lost a job that I had been at for a year at the first regime of the Lincoln Center Theater. So I was just really down and out. I was living over a drugstore in Greenwich Village, having no job and being alone for the first time in my adult life. So I thought, well, I'd like to get a job and in a field that excites me, which had not been the case previously. So I thought, I'll get a job at the theater. I'm not an actress, but I had a family history of five women in my family who had, had been actresses. So I thought, well, I'll try to connect with the theater in some way. So I wrote 88 letters to people who had been listed as producers of the old telephone books we used to have, and sent them in the mail, and waited in my little apartment over the drugstore for the phone to ring. And it rang one day, and it was someone from the New York Shakespeare Festival, which was the predecessor of the Public Theater. And he offered me a job in the park, so in Central Park. So as part of my job, I accidentally met Joe Papp, who needed someone to assist him when he was directing a Shakespeare play in the park. So I became that assistant. And although this was a kind of a lowly summer temp job, I stayed on when he invited me to join the staff on a permanent basis. So it just happened that 65 was also the year that he had the idea of going beyond his producing Shakespeare and founding the Public Theater. And he was starting to search for the building where that might happen. So 65 was a watershed year for both myself personally and also for Joe in his career as a producer when he began producing New American Work.
Right. When you talk about first meeting him and your impressions of what he was like, I really appreciate the time you take. And it really helps us understand what a complex or complicated man he was. Sometimes we use that term and we don't really mean it as a compliment, and I do mean it as a compliment. I mean, he is such an intriguing mixture of different characteristics. And one of them that you talk about a little bit in this chapter that I would love to have you kind of expand on is the interesting mix between casual and formal that seems to have been part of him. I'm going to just read one short little passage here and then have you kind of say more about it. You write, although he had a casual and friendly personality, he frowned on unmerited verbal familiarity, and I winced when someone presumed to call him Joe on too brief acquaintance. Papp's curt rejoinder had been, Mr. Papp, to you. And in the paragraph right before it ends with this intriguing line: his contradictions kept you on your toes. Tell us more about that and what it was like to get to know this man with such an intriguing personality.
Well, it was interesting because I had worked for complicated people before, mostly in the publishing field, and I had always gotten along with difficult people for some reason, complex and difficult people. I've always been sort of attracted to them. And so his contradictions in his face-to-face dealings with the staff, for instance, were really very interesting to me. I immediately interpreted them as interesting and complex, and I found them really just fascinating and not terribly perplexing or difficult as some other people did. Some people felt that he was inconsistent and sometimes interpreted the way he behaved as aggressive. And I didn't. I saw that there was five different ways you could interpret things he might say and what lay behind them. And that just fascinated me and engaged me. Other people had very different reactions to Joan. I'm totally aware of that. And he was often, I felt, misinterpreted in the media as to what kind of person he was. And that became actually one of the objections, one of the objectives in my book, which is to try to give a more nuanced description of the kind of person that he was, which I felt was largely missing in the media accounts of what he was like.
Hmm.
I found that people who wrote about him often quoted each other and used the same adjectives about him over the course of, you know, two decades. I saw the same adjectives popping up. Some of them were fairly harmless, like he was continuously described as peripatetic, which I thought, well, that's interesting. Yes, he did move around and get around a bit, but there were other adjectives that weren't so neutral.
Hmm.
And I thought, that's not good. That'll be on the record. And I just wanted to establish a different kind of more nuanced record about the kind of person that he was.
Right.
So that was certainly one of the objectives in the book that I always had.
I think you you satisfy that objective really, really beautifully. And I think he emerges as a very vivid presence in the book. I also appreciate the fact that you give us some background on Joe Papp and his career, even before the two of you met and began working together. And
right.
You do, among other things, give us an account of what you characterize as his legendary fight with Robert Moses, New York City's powerful, multi-hatted parks commissioner. And that was over a big fracas they had where Mr. Moses wanted Joe Papp to begin charging admission to what had been these free Shakespeare performances in Central Park. And and so people who aren't acquainted with this interesting story can read all about it in your book. But I think it's really great to have this example of what a fighter he was. I mean,
yes.
That this was somebody who not only passionately loved theater and passionately wanted to share it with a very wide public, but he was also willing to fight for what he believed in, maybe more so and maybe more effectively than others who might have maybe shared his love of theater but not known how to scratch and claw for what he
right.
wanted to have happen.
Yeah, well, he came out of Joe's background partly because he had grown up very poor, the son of immigrant parents in Brooklyn, and from an early age, he'd had to fight his way on the streets, and he learned how to do that, and he also learned many other things from the street that were positive, but he was used to scrapping for his own rights and his own safety, and so as an adult, those skills that he learned on the street came into play in relationship to someone as big as Robert Moses. But he was always civil in his speech when he was engaged in those fights. He was never low in his tactics. He was always very civil, but extraordinarily effective and just fearless.
Mm-hmm.
He was willing to lose everything for a point and a principle, which is not true of everybody, as we've seen recently.
Very true. Well said.
So I think that's instructive.
Mm.
Not everybody is willing to lose everything, but Joe was. He would have lost the public theater at a certain point if it came to push and shove. He was willing to go back into a different level of life in terms of his income, so forth and so on. He was willing to risk those things, which not everybody is or can't or would do, but he was really and truly like that, which was just amazing. So I admired that immensely. And also, having grown up on the streets, he had a tough skin. He had a sensitive soul, but a tough skin. So he was able to engage in these mighty disputes, especially in the early days, that periled his doing of Free Shakespeare. And later on, he was able to engage with drama critics who also were very unkind to his early enterprise at the Public Theater. So Joe had that, and he was constantly engaged in these disputes, which were mostly published arguments that he made against the criticisms of what he was trying to do. And I saw these struggles blow by blow, and it was really fascinating and instructive. He wasn't injured personally by them. It was always for the preservation of his democratic ideas that were at the foundation of the theaters that he'd founded. He was a fiercely democratic person. He was a true citizen and patriot. And since I grew up during World War II, I resonated with that totally because I was a very democratic little girl back then. And I understood those feelings of allegiance to the, you know, the fragile democratic idea that is the heart of our country's founding. So I thought those battles that he waged were something along those lines that I understood very well based on my own childhood and the feelings I had then.
Sure. We're speaking with Gail Merrifield Papp about her new memoir, Public Private, My Life with Joe Papp at the Public Theater. When you go to work for Joe Papp, one of the first really significant responsibilities you are given is to assist him in a production of Troilus and Cressida, and you are asked to take his director's notes.
Right.
Something that you had absolutely never done. In fact, you write, "This was a completely unexpected development, and I was panic-stricken. Why on earth had he asked me? I had no academic or theatrical background in Shakespeare, let alone any experience in taking a director's notes." Briefly describe to our listeners what kind of assignment this was, what made it so challenging, and the immense relief you must have felt that it ultimately went as well as it did.
Well, Troilus and Cressida was typically referred to as one of Shakespeare's, quote, problem plays, although scholars would disagree with that now. But it's got this huge cast of mythical people like Ajax and Achilles and so forth, and with two sides warring against each other, lots and lots of characters, and complicated developments and so forth and so on. I had never read the play. I had 2 days after Joe asked me to take his notes to read the play and try to catch up on what it was all about. So I did that, and when I followed him into the theater in Central Park for the first time at the first preview to take his notes, I saw the beautiful amphitheater for the first time, and it was just a remarkable sight. But I was all keyed up to take his notes because I had never done anything like that. I thought, how do I take notes in the dark, for one thing? But I got a lighted pen, so that helps me. And Joe, who spoke very rapidly, started the minute the play started, he began to whisper notes to me in the dark. And I thought, oh, God, and I had to write them down. The purpose of my notes being that after the show, he would speak to the cast and give his notes to the cast based on the notes that I'd taken to remind him of what he wanted to say about whatever. So they couldn't be illegible. They had to be legible, and they had to be somehow intelligible. So it was a very fierce assignment for me to get up to speed really fast, virtually overnight, to do this. And it was really my first association with Joe at the Delacorte Theater. And I managed to keep up to speed, amazingly. And he was able to read his notes. This was night after night during all the previews. that we were there, and Joe was giving me these very fast spoken notes in the dark about what was going on the stage, and I could seldom look up from my notes to look at the stage even to see what was happening. So it was a challenge. I'd never done it before. The notes had to be automatically separated as I took them for different actors, for different stage crews and so forth. They had to be immediately separated out. And this was just a fearsome assignment.
you say, watching the previews of Troilus and Cressida with Joe became a crash course for me in Shakespearean performance, as well as in practical matters concerning costume, scenery, lighting, and especially sound design. And by the way, you mentioned that the role of Ajax in this production was played by a very young James Earl Jones, who will figure prominently later on. And in the following chapter is one of my favorite lines, when you say at one point, "I was beginning to learn that Joe disapproved of any suggestion that Shakespeare was out of reach to the common man or woman." And certainly that is one of the abiding themes of his entire career.
It certainly is. Yes, and he was absolutely right about it. Mm. All you had to do was, for instance, go to the Delacorte Theater in Central Park, or go to see one of the shows that he toured on a mobile theater back then, and the audiences were smarter and more responsive than the audience you will find in a Broadway theater. They were immediately reactive to what was going on the stage. They got all the humor, absolutely bar none. They got all the humor of Shakespeare, and they rooted for various people in the play in the most remarkable fashion. I just loved being on the side of the mobile theater audience, because they were so vital, so responsive, and smart. It was really something to be on that side of things.
Of course.
Just terrific.
We're speaking with Gail Merrifield Papp about her book, Public Private, My Life with Joe Papp at the Public Theater. It's time for us to get to that matter, that what is called a radical change in mission, the title of the seventh chapter of the book, when Joe Papp decides that that his life in the theater cannot be limited to Shakespeare in the Park or Shakespeare period, but he has this hunger for a new adventure involving new American plays. Tell us more about this critical juncture in his career and what you think was at the heart of it, the heart of his hunger to undertake something like this.
Well, you know, Joe had always been, I guess you would say, politically engaged at the time he was in his teens on the streets of Brooklyn. He used to get on top of soapboxes and talk about what was going on during the Depression. During the Depression, he would help people move back into their apartments who had been evicted and so forth. He had a socially motivated kind of engagement from his teens, and that continued into his adult life in various ways. So he was always aware of what was going on. He'd also served in the Navy. He was aware of what was going on in the world and in society. And although he was producing Shakespeare, he was constantly in touch with that aspect of his interests and his engagement. So after doing Shakespeare with a very powerful democratic idea behind it for a number of years, he felt he wanted to engage with the current voices in the theater in terms of the playwrights, which, of course, doing Shakespeare only, it was not part of the agenda up to that point. So I remember when he first announced it to his board of trustees, they were astonished because nobody had been prepared for this. Joe said, "I want to do new American plays at a permanent theater." Well, he had no permanent theater outside of the summer amphitheater. He operated at that time out of a rented hotel office, in a kind of a scroungy hotel. And the idea of finding a building in which to do contemporary works was just off the charts. But that's what he wanted to do. He told me, he said, "No, I have no money to do this. I just want to do it." So he started looking, and he found the building that the public theater now operates from, which is a former public library. It's quite a beautiful 19th century structure, which he managed to acquire and renovate. And that's where he opened the public theater with Hare. But that desire of his was quite remarkable, because he could have gone on doing free Shakespeare in the manner that he'd been doing, and nobody would have objected, and he would have had a certain kind of renown, which he did have already. And nobody would say, well, but you're not doing new American plays. But he had that restlessness in his character, where he was never satisfied with what he was doing at present. He was always looking to the future in some fashion that was part of his fundamental restlessness and dissatisfaction and yearning for the next step, and which he could be useful. Mm. Joe wanted to be useful to people. Mm. He had a very strong bent that way.
Right.
So I think this change of mission came partly out of that.
One of the things that was quite extraordinary, and it sounds like you were really taken aback when you discovered this as well. You tell us at the end of chapter 8, when it is clear that that this public theater will be opening, and this will be where it will open, and all kinds of exciting possibilities stretch ahead. You write at one point, "I was so caught up in the excitement about our move to the future public theater that it wasn't until Joe casually mentioned to me one day that he did not personally know any playwrights that I understood what a vulnerable position we were starting from. Apparently, he had few contacts or irons in the fire. What he had instead was a vision that might possibly be as undefined or nebulous as the legendary Astor Library ghost rumored to have haunted the occult book stacks in the 19th century. I mean, it's a really interesting observation, but I think it's really also interesting because I think sometimes things like this get undertaken on, you know, maybe a more modest scale, but it's because somebody knows a whole bunch of young, up-and-coming right. playwrights and wants to create opportunities for them, and in a sense, it's very much driven by the personal, and in this case, it was driven by the principal. I mean, it's not that Joe Papp knew all these young playwrights and was eager to give them a chance. It had nothing to do with those kind of relationships. It had to do with the principle of the thing, and he was willing to take a huge leap of faith to try to make this happen.
That's absolutely right. You know, other people have social connections in New York City. Joe had no social connections, zero. I mean, he was not invited to any kind of circles of influential people and that sort of thing, their dinner parties or whatever. He never had that. He was really never interested in it. So that didn't exist. He had no major donors to help him with his idea. He really started it from scratch. So that's an amazing way to start a theater back then. It was virtually unprecedented, and the fact that it became a major theatrical institution was never dreamed of at the moment. And I remember myself feeling that, oh my gosh, in my office one day, I said, I think maybe we're an institution. I thought, oh, that's interesting. This is an institution. That really hadn't occurred to me before, but of course it was true. And it's the way people then began to approach the public theater.
Right.
But Joe started from this unfunded premise and took it from there. He had to scrabble together money to put a down payment on the building that he eventually was able to buy, and that he eventually got the city to buy back from him, so that he was reimbursed for the then extraordinary expense of $512,000. And so bit by bit and step by step, he managed to get it on a fairly stable basis, but it was touch and go for many years. We had many plans for going out of business and maybe retreating to the basement and renting the rest of the building to somebody else while he tried to get the money together to refurbish it, which it badly needed. It was very deteriorated. And so he always had a kind of disaster scenario in the back of his mind, which a few of us would join him somewhere else if we had to, temporarily, while the whole enterprise got on a firmer financial footing. It was very touch and go that way, very risky. And nobody who's in who was in their sober mind would have recommended it.
Well, and at one point you say, because Joel was a self-assured person with two decades of theatrical experience, it took me a while to appreciate the steep learning curve he was actually going through in creating the public theater. This is a new adventure, really, for all of us. You tell us the story of that memorable and extraordinary show, which was the first thing, the very first show to be presented at the public theater, namely Galt McDermott's amazing and groundbreaking musical Hair. And,
right.
And at one point, there's this, I mean, you tell us, you know, a whole lot of interesting stories about that, but one of the sentences that just leapt out at me was when you write, Hair would be the first show to which Joe had ever sold tickets.
Right.
That's just kind of makes reminds us of what an unprecedented venture this was for him, man who had championed free Shakespeare in the public.
Problem in his mind, because he'd been having, you know, audiences to whom he gave free tickets, you know, for 15 years. So it was very perplexing at that point. Well, what relationship does he have to audiences now that they're paying? You know, that was a sore question in his mind that he had to work through in some fashion.
Right.
Because
you tell us that, you know, at the early going, I mean, because he had no contacts, just getting your hands on brand new plays that potentially might be done at the public theater, that was a huge challenge. But with the great success of Hair, now, very quickly, you are essentially inundated with new possibilities, and you became one of the people to kind of assist with that as potential scripts came pouring in.
Right.
Tell us
what they arrived in the mailbag that was put on my desk every morning. So I had done some script reading, and I'd worked at Lincoln Center where I'd been fired, actually. And so I had some background in reading scripts. There was nobody else around to read them. So I fished the mail out of the bag and read the scripts that came along with it. After Hair, I couldn't do that. There were just too many of them. So we developed a freelance reading group to help with that. And that was kind of the beginning of a play department, which took a few years. But it started to happen out of Joe's office, and that eventually it became a separate unit in the public theater premises, and I was eventually the director of it, but its origins were extremely humble.
Right. And it's interesting you tell us how that one of the challenges is that many elements you don't really actually see on the page, and you write, I think I benefited from having grown up with radio rather than television because it had developed my auditory imagination when reading. I want to be sure, before we run out of time, to have you talk a moment about A Chorus Line, which, of course, was one of the other landmark successes of the public theater. And of course, we can read all kinds of details about that in your book. But what I want to have you talk about is, in a sense, the uneasy relationship that Joe Papp had with huge commercial success. I mean, with just kind of commercialism in general. And for instance, when something might go from the public theater, which is down in the Flatiron District, to Broadway, that was not something that he was particularly comfortable with or really even enjoyed.
No,
could you talk about that relationship with commercial success that with which your husband had to kind of contend?
Yeah, he didn't like it. I mean, he learned to embrace it as a nonprofit producer, but he'd grown up as a what I would call a pragmatic radical, and he was attached to some of those ideas that he had in his 20s up to the time that he founded the public theater. So initially, he wasn't really very interested or excited if there was a commercial move as a result of something he produced, either at the Central Park Theater or downtown at the Public Theater. That didn't excite him the way it excited other kinds of producers. So he had to gradually adjust himself to the realities that other people had for the work that he produced, which was they would like it to become successful and move to Broadway and make money. So by the time that A Chorus Line came along, it was just an idea that the director and creator, Michael Bennett, had. So he just posed the idea to Joe. There was no music. There was no choreographer. There's no story. There was nothing that existed except an idea that people who had been dancers had recorded their recollections, and Michael Bennett had them on tape. So Joe listened to those tapes, and he was very moved by them, especially by the spirit of the dancers who spoke on them, who told about their backgrounds and their youthful aspirations and so forth. He identified very strongly with the kind of worker sensibility in them. And when Michael wanted to do this musical, which meant to create it from scratch, actually, Joe was very supportive because he identified with those stories of the dancers. And he was able to get funding for a workshop development of this idea from the chairman of our board at that time. So it went forward, and after several months, it had started to resemble a show. And that became A Chorus Line.
Hmm. Well, we can read much more about that and other exciting adventures in your book. And I appreciate the fact that at the end, in an epilogue, you briefly tell the story of the three artistic directors who followed after your husband.
Yes.
and continuing the legacy of excellence with the public theater. And there's an appendix in which we can see this absolutely extraordinary list of all of the noteworthy actors, choreographers, composers, directors, playwrights who have been part of the unparalleled legacy of the public theater. It's one of just many things to enjoy in your wonderful book, which is again titled Public Private, My Life with Joe Papp at the Public Theater, published by Applause Theater and Cinema Books. There are great photographs here as well to help tell this story even more vividly. The author, Gail Merrifield Papp. Gail Merrifield Papp, I congratulate you on a really terrific book, and I thank you not only for writing it and sharing it with the world, but also for being my morning show guest. What a pleasure and honor to speak with you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
This weekend on the podcast version of the morning show, two interesting interviews out of the morning show archives. Tomorrow, a conversation with Michael Finkel, a former writer for the New York Times Magazine, talking about his book, True Story, Murder Memoir, Mea Culpa. Michael Finkel lost his job at the New York Times under very embarrassing circumstances, and then almost immediately in the wake of that, his identity was stolen by a convicted murderer on the run. And this amazing but true story is told in this memoir, which eventually was turned into a major motion picture. And on Sunday, Peter Smith and a lovely book called Two of Us, the story of a father, a son, and the Beatles. On Monday's program, Ed Hayden and his book, The Modern Maverick, Why Writing Your Own Rules is Better for You, Your Work, and the World. On Tuesday, Dr. Art Sear. On Wednesday, we preview upcoming theatrical productions by the Lakeside Players.